I knew enough of medicine to realize that my blood approached coagulation point and that if the fever increased by only another degree, I should die. I tossed about in bed, too weak to call anyone, and there was no bell. After a second's full consciousness, I lapsed back into my former condition. The boys in pure white robes still looked very concerned. Allel, their feelings found a visible impression in their expressive faces. They stood behind me, but during my nightmare I could see forward and backward at the same time. The demons, however, had no individual expression in their faces. They were all alike. There was no personality about them. They seemed to mechanically carry out the behests of someone else. The boys seemed to possess strong individualities. This very individuality was their best defense against the large army of spiritual dummies. But it grew too hot for them. Another few seconds and they would be vanquished and my heart torn open by the demons. Then one of the boys blew a silver trumpet, and, with the suddenness of an eagle pouncing down from the sky, a glorious figure descended from heaven like a flash of lightning. His face was a curious mixture of the face of a lion and that of a handsome young man. His voice sounded like the roar of the sea swelling into one mighty harmony when he almost roared the words, "Leave this child alone," and struck the host of demons with a sword that seemed to be made of solar substance, as it shone like the sun in all its glory. The demons scattered in all directions. Some of them fled, others suddenly turned into mice, rats, and frogs, and disappeared in the ground, and all was quiet. I was fully conscious again. I felt that the fever had just reached its highest point, and that I was on the mend. For the first time in many years I had been actually ill. I was too weak to stand up to fetch something to wipe away the perspiration in which I was bathed. Only half an hour later I felt strong enough to stand up and light the lamp. I had no further nightmares that night. I only felt terribly thirsty and drank several pints of water. In the forenoon, while everybody else in the holy city seemed to be asleep, I went out for a walk. I had never walked so slowly since I had entered Tibet. When I was a mile outside the city of the initiates, I stripped off my clothes and took a sunbathe in the glorious sunshine. I took in the flood of warmth and life with great gratitude. Never before had I felt such an influx of strength in such a short time. About noon I walked back. After coming home I drank a few more pints of water, and when the gong sounded 9 times to mark breakfast time I had almost entirely recovered. When I smilingly greeted Narabu, he only observed that I looked a little thinner. He had not the faintest idea that I had been within inches of death the night before. Just as we sat down to breakfast, a message was handed to Narabu on a golden plate. He reverently broke the seal. He could hardly hide his emotion when he told me, "Mani Rinpoche, the exalted jewel, arrived here unexpectedly yesterday at midnight. I had an audience of the Prince of Light at 2 o'clock this morning and mentioned you to him. Did he know something about me?" "I think he did. But all he was graciously pleased to say was that I should at once give instructions to all concerned that you should be treated with quite exceptional courtesy and attention, and that the matter of your audience which one had respectfully proposed to him would be examined a little later. And now," added Narabu, "I have just received his decision. You will be received at the palace at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, and I notice that a full half hour has been set aside for your audience, which I can assure you is an exceptionally long time. Even so-called long audiences granted by the Prince of Light do not last longer than 7 minutes. And only once in years has so great a privilege been accorded to a guest coming to the city of the initiates. I hope you like the city," added Narabu. "Yes," I observed politely, "everything here seems to be so very clean and so well organized. And how about the psychical atmosphere? Are you pleased with that?" "It is very strange," I said. "I feel like someone who is dead and has forgotten to leave behind his physical body."
"You mean you feel like a man who visits the beyond in the flesh?"
"Yes," I said. "It is a very strange feeling and a very strange place." "The culminating point of your stay will be your audience with him," Narabu observed. "Breakfast,
which consisted of only one somewhat more substantial dish, was over, and I walked back to my room. I first took several hours' rest to recover as much as possible of my strength lost in the fever, and then began to wash a piece of linen. I was fully aware of the fact that I broke another rule of the city by washing my linen in the room instead of giving it to a servant to be handled in the sanitation building, but as I am always reluctant to let other people touch my own personal effects and never use other people's services when it is not absolutely necessary, I bolted the door and began to wash that piece myself. Hardly had I soaked the linen when the wooden bowl which stood in the room for washing suddenly broke into several small pieces. It was a most unusual experience. The bowl was fairly strong and I had handled it with the usual care. Later in the afternoon I met some of Naobu's friends whose acquaintance I had made in the dining building. I still felt a little tired and did not talk very much myself, but their conversation, during which they discussed various internal affairs of the holy city, proved to be extremely interesting. I gathered, for instance, that sexual intercourse, even in the case of married people, could only be used for the purpose of procreation. All sexual energy unused for this purpose had to be transformed into higher forces to serve the interests of the brotherhood. Even the sex force of the members does not belong to them but to the prince. It must be used for begetting children to be brought up in his spirit or for the purpose of creating spiritual energy to fill the spiritual reservoir of the initiates. A veritable anthill mentality seemed to reign in the holy city in regard to everything connected with sex matters. I thought of my strange experience with the wooden bowl. The Holy Brotherhood may have had ways and means of controlling even the most intimate marital secrets of their members. Has life any meaning, I pondered, if we deprive it of all possibility of self-expression? What is life minus freedom, variety, and personality? A meaningless void I in the house of the Creator there must be many abodes, I thought. I had always believed that if I love and honor God, love my neighbor and love myself, God would let me do everything I like so long as I respected these three laws. Conversation drifted to other topics. Some of the members present expressed spiritual indignation at the many sins committed in the world. They hoped that the exalted jewel would punish all those who caused so much injustice and so much suffering. I could not help feeling that practically all of the people present had a slight touch of what may be called spiritual arrogance. The most arrogant ones seemed to be the most sheepish ones when the conversation centered around the Prince of Light and the Great Holy Teachers. Footnote. Late in the afternoon I returned to my room. The servant had replaced the broken bowl by another one and no one said a word about the matter. I tried to think clearly, but the longer I stayed in the holy city the more difficult it seemed to be to keep out unconscious influences when forming one's thoughts. I took dinner very quietly, smiled to Naobu, and returned to my room. The faculty to think clearly diminished after each meal. Moreover, I felt that my body revolted against the food taken. I am a man of quick decisions. After the fourth meal taken in the holy city, it was obvious that the food did not agree with me. Moreover, every time I had eaten something in the dining building, I felt very strongly that unconscious influences impaired my capacity to think. Maybe all this was mere coincidence or a wrong impression. Be that as it may, I decided not to take any chances. I went to bed about 8 p.m. and had a much better night's rest than the day before. I awoke feeling footnote. Also amongst non-spiritual people the author has often noticed that arrogance and sheepishness go hand in hand. Much stronger and decided to walk and run 20 miles non-stop to the nearest village and back again to buy food. I started at 3 in the morning and returned some time after 12. When the 9 strokes of the gong sounded and the servant came in to announce in his dreadfully lifeless voice, "My lord, our guest. The first meal of the day is served," I simply said, "I shall not go to breakfast." He mechanically repeated his sentence, "My lord, our guest. The first meal of the day is served." I thought the fellow would make an excellent doorkeeper and let him stand there to repeat his stereotyped phrase as often as he liked. He then went to fetch the superintendent of the building. I told the latter that I did not intend to partake of meals and did not wish to go to the dining house. But, my lord, all our guests are expected to go to the dining house twice a day. I shall not, I said, politely but firmly. I understood that guests here were free to do what they liked. He bowed and withdrew. Immediately afterwards a servant sent by Naobu came in inquiring whether I was ill. I sent my greetings and the news that I was all right. A minute later another servant sent by Lamoshan arrived to gather information about my health. I thanked her for her kind interest, adding the message that I was not ill and only required solitude instead of attention. A little while later a third servant came along to learn whether my health permitted me to keep the time fixed for the audience in the palace in the afternoon. I replied that I should certainly come, and had I felt that I would be unable to come I should not have failed to let them know myself. This brought the series of messages to a conclusion. I locked the door and calmly prepared my own breakfast, mixing barley meal with a little butter and a few dried radishes. I had bought sufficient food in the village to last for at least 4 days. Curiously enough, this self-prepared meal did not seem to impair my capacity to think, and I wondered whether this was an actual fact or a mere erroneous impression brought about by auto suggestion. An hour later I went to join Naobu and a few of his friends. I did not want this good and kind-hearted man to think that he or anyone else in the holy city had done anything to offend me and to make him suspect that I had a discourteous reason for staying away from the meals. 10 minutes before 3 I arrived at the palace for the audience. At that moment I really thought the Prince of Light was a sincere spiritual leader and the head of an occult brotherhood whose supreme goal was to honor the Creator and help the world. The only thing I disliked about him was the extraordinary cloud of majesty with which he seemed to surround himself. But then I thought it might be a mere compromise. He probably felt that he could carry out his work much better if he cloaked himself with such an appearance. And as I am always inclined to look for the substance rather than the shadow, I did not consider this splendor to be a proof of insincerity. Most people do such things on a smaller scale, I thought. At the time when I gave my first broadcast in 1933 I positively detested collars, which I considered both unpractical and idiotic, and yet when I went to see the talk's executive in a continental country I did put on a collar, because I realized that if I appeared in the broadcasting house minus a collar I should never succeed in securing an interview with the talk's executive, and that it would be stupid to sacrifice the opportunity of giving a broadcast for the sake of not putting on a collar. The Prince of Light, I thought, was doing the same thing on a larger scale, and I was prepared to pardon him. I walked down the palace stairs. The entrance was guarded. 4 lifeless servants stood there like so many stone statues. A 5th servant approached, bowed, and lighted a torch. The heavy double door was swung open by other servants. And after a pause of about 2 minutes I was escorted downstairs by not less than 7 servants. Down and down we went. Landing followed landing. I had never realized how enormous such an underground building could be. At least 12 landings were behind us when we arrived at the bottom of the staircase situated at a depth of perhaps 100 feet under the main entrance of the palace. Another heavy door was swung open and I found myself in a small hall lit by torches. The time was exactly 3 o'clock. Obviously our paces had been timed very carefully so as to make me arrive downstairs at 3 o'clock sharp, which was the time fixed for the audience. Another servant approached with a golden sprayer and poured on me an abundant supply of perfume. I had certainly not expected to be fumigated in this manner before entering the inner precincts of the palace. But perhaps the prince had established this wise general rule for his own benefit in case a person having genuine Tibetan ideas about hygiene and cleanliness should happen to be invited as a guest by a member of the Holy Brotherhood and secure an audience. While I was being fumigated in this manner, I looked round. 9 small underground passages ran out from the small hall in all directions. They probably connected the palace with the other parts of the underground city. The idea struck me that at least one of the underground passages may have been connected with a place several miles distant to enable the prince or any of his lieutenants to enter and leave the holy city in a secret manner. A system of air pipes justified the assumption that at least two of the underground passages measured several miles in length. Each of the passages was guarded by at least four servants, some of them probably used for dispatching messages. Wherever the visitor looked, his eyes fell on the lifeless faces of those servants who reminded one of so many corpses just risen from their coffins. The heavy door on the opposite side of the small hall was thrown open. I entered the large entrance hall to the inner part of the palace. From now onwards I only met members of the Brotherhood. No servant, as Naobu told me later, is permitted to enter the inner palace. The large hall measured about 30 by 40 yards. It was illuminated by hundreds of torches stuck into golden sockets in the walls and round the pillars, and fed through pipes with a liquid burning with a smokeless flame. Like many other halls in the holy city, it was connected by air pipes with a large room in the sanitation building, where several dozen servants kept the fans going from about 11 a.m. to 3 a.m. the following day. I was met by seven members of the Holy Brotherhood in gorgeous robes. A thick black robe of pure silk embroidered with a large number of tsungs footnote was brought, together with seven silk cushions. Slowly and ceremoniously the seven cushions were heaped one on another, and then one of the gorgeously dressed brothers stepped on them, unfolded the robe, and got ready to cloak me with it. At that moment the masters of ceremony probably received the greatest shock of their lives. I flatly refused to put on a ceremonial robe of any kind. If your master is as great as you affirm, I said, politely but firmly, he must know himself whether I am great or small. I do not want any special dress to improve my appearance when appearing before him. They were dumbfounded. As Naobu told me in footnote, magical formulae. The evening, I had also broken the rule of absolute silence which must reign in the large underground hall and in the whole left half of the palace which is used by the prince. No one is allowed to utter a word there unless it is in reply to a question or in reference to a command uttered by the Prince of Light. Several other masters of ceremony of a still higher rank were summoned in a hurry. I was surrounded by a never-increasing crowd of dignitaries who in turn tried to convince me in respectful whispers of the absolute necessity of putting on the black silk gown before stepping into the august presence of the ruler. So much fuss about such a formality. It really was funny. After about 5 minutes' continual whispering, I thought it was useless to take up their time any longer and said with profound respect, "I apologize for having broken your rules, but I thought I had come here for an informal audience and not on solemn official business. Will you please present my respects to Mani Rinpoche?" I turned towards the exit and began to walk out. The crowd of masters of ceremony rushed after me. "You cannot go now," they whispered in a faltering voice. "The audience already began the moment you entered the inner part of the palace." An interrupted audience, one such a thing has never been heard of one inch. "I notice that the whole reception is intended to be mere ceremony," I said coolly. "I have not come to the city to get something, but in order to assist and cooperate of my own free will with sincere spiritual helpers. I have no time for ceremonies. I suggest that one of you puts on that black silk robe and goes through the show on my behalf. I shall not put it on. This is final." I bowed and turned towards the exit. They had no power to hold me back. At that moment a high court official dressed in pure white silk came running down from the staircase leading to the upper parts of the palace and literally shouted, "Please stop one, the exalted jewel will welcome you as you are." Naobu told me in the evening that it was for the first time in its history that someone had shouted in the inner part of the palace. I returned. The seven masters of ceremony walked in front with seven torches, and the brothers of high rank, who had been called to the rescue later on account of this unusual happening, brought up the rear. On the upper landing I was respectfully welcomed by another high official wearing a white silk robe. We entered a richly decorated hall situated on top of the former one. Other court officials approached. They could hardly believe their eyes when they saw a person coming up for an audience dressed in ordinary clothes. They advanced to take my shoes off and replace them by a pair of felt shoes richly adorned with silver ornaments. I told them very politely that I was unwilling to let go of my own shoes, but if they thought they were not clean enough, I had no objection to having them cleaned. For the first time since I had entered the palace, I saw a faint smile. There were two staircases in this second hall. The right one, as Naobu told me later, leading to the private apartments of the court officials, and the left one to the ceremonial rooms where the audience was to be held. An enormously long corridor, very wide and measuring several hundred yards in length, ran out from one of their walls of the hall, and for the first time the idea occurred to me that the underground city might be very much larger than it appeared to be, and that only members who had passed the highest initiations had access to the most secret parts. When we had ascended the staircase, we reached a still more gorgeously decorated hall, this time dimly lit by daylight coming down through the ceiling. 9 other masters of ceremony, led by the court martial, all dressed in white robes richly embroidered with gold, led me upstairs once more in a solemn procession. I realized that I was right near the audience room, as we must have reached the uppermost part of the palace, since brilliant daylight was flooding in through the ceiling. I was met by 2 members of the Brotherhood, probably acting in the capacity of private secretaries to the prince. The high official and the 9 masters of ceremony dressed in white silk bowed and withdrew. I began to talk to the secretaries in a low voice, but they did not answer and put their ringers before their mouths. One decidedly, all these ceremonies, probably destined to impress people with awe and expectation, were lost on me. I considered them rather boring and disrespectfully thought of a circus. Someone passed carrying an occidental easy chair. They seemed to arrange the audience room specially for me. A few minutes later, it was perhaps 3:20, one of the secretaries solemnly announced in whispers, "Will you please come into the presence of the ruler?" One left the anteroom, which was full of costly vases and expensive carpets, and entered a somewhat smaller room where the exalted jewel or prince of light was seated in a corner. He rose when I entered, met me about halfway, and gave me his left hand with great cordiality. "The left one is nearer to the heart," he said smilingly, in excellent English. "The prince of light, as Naobu told me afterwards, speaks and writes 6 languages perfectly, viz. Tibetan, English, French, Chinese, Hindustani, and Sanskrit." I sat down in the western easy chair that had been specially brought in for the audience and made myself just as comfortable as if I had been in the parlor of a man of small means who would casually invite me to visit his house. "You are a man of great capacity," said the prince, "and you will have to fulfill a great mission in this incarnation. The next few days will be of vital importance to you. The experience and portent of a whole series of lives will be crowded for you into the space of hours. You are called upon to take perhaps the greatest decision you have ever been called upon to make, not only in this life but also in hundreds of previous existences. No one can force your hands. You yourself must make your decision in perfect freedom." He talked like a king or emperor. Every word seemed to have its portent, and he seemed to be fully conscious of the formidable power he wielded. If Naobu was right, I was in the presence of one of the greatest powers on earth. His voice was refined, strong, and beautiful, but had a slightly metallic sound. It was very deep too. He was very tall and had a long white beard. He looked like a mixture of Pythagoras with a slightly Jewish touch and a refined modern Tibetan belonging to the aristocracy of the country. When our eyes met, I had the strange feeling as of something in me fleeing away from him with great eagerness, but it was only an inexplicable reflex, and since I had had so many conflicting and contradictory spiritual experiences ever since I had come to the holy city, I paid no further attention to it. We talked about our respective spheres of activity, my expeditions and my plays. "You have an iron will," he observed, "but this is not enough. You sometimes accomplish things because of your boundless energy. That is not enough. You must acquire the power to make your environment obey you." He mentioned 2 Sanskrit words to illustrate the difference between wanting a thing and commanding a thing to come your way. He seemed to prompt me to try to put myself on a level with the Creator when I, on the other hand, knew that my greatest asset in life had been a capacity to live fully, to be a creature. A powerful creature in my own way but yet a child of the Creator, and I had never tried to be like the Maker by commanding things to come my way. We then talked about spiritual mistakes. He said that they did not matter. If a man stumbles and falls, he seemed to imply, he would rise again. It occurred to me that there was at least one dreadful mistake in the spiritual realm. If man throws his soul away, he cannot make amends for it. He cannot take it back afterwards. There are mistakes which are fatal for all eternity. One, if a man jumps from a skyscraper, he may undo in a few seconds all he has built up in a lifetime, I thought. I rather disliked his saying that a mistake never mattered, for one can make amends for it. I knew that there are mistakes for which making amends is impossible. I felt as if this had been said to rush my decision, and immediately the lion temperament in me began to assert itself. From spiritual mistakes the conversation drifted to the question of power. Yo, you could become more powerful, he observed meaningly. At what price? I asked. That you must discover for yourself, he answered. We talked about his brotherhood. He illustrated how impersonal he was. The individual often disappeared before his eyes. He then only saw principles at work. And great principles they were. Guests did not always realize this. Sometimes guests come here who have sacrificed everything for doing so and who go hungry for weeks to be able to come here. Let them be hungry. It is good for them to be hungry, he said with cold emphasis. I looked at him as he sat there in his costly robes. He seemed to sense what was going on within me. I hope you do not misunderstand me, he added, and changed the topic. Our conversation gradually touched deeper problems, such as the contrast between East and West, bloody wars and catastrophes of nature, and how all these things had deeper causes. He even touched on the problem of politics, dictatorships, footnote, and mass rule, and seems to be against sport one as I never touch in my books and lectures on any problem which is directly or indirectly connected with politics. I shall withhold the details. I thought I had already overstepped the time allowed for the audience, and meant to close it by making a few polite remarks about my refusal to put on the ceremonial robe made of black silk. Then he smiled for the first time. Yo, you are the first person who has ever entered this part of the palace in clothes like this. I hope you will now realize how little value we really attach to matters of pomp and circumstance. Footnote. Ancient Coriolanus, by Shakespeare, and found that he knew it very thoroughly, since he expressed his opinion in a very circumstantial way and also gave a considerable number of details showing that he must have read the play several times. I sincerely wished I could believe him, but I couldn't. Suddenly I felt that many people were waiting outside as the time allotted to them had arrived. I positively knew they were waiting. As explained before, the atmosphere of the city developed these faculties in a strange manner. I rose and wished to withdraw, but he requested me to stay, saying that he greatly appreciated our conversation. I thanked him and sat down again. I casually mentioned my future plans and was anxious to find out what he would do under such and such circumstances. I never give advice to anybody, he said. I then broached the subject of religious ceremonies, and after having talked for a while about these matters, I asked his permission to attend divine service in the temple on the condition that I should be present as a visitor and on the understanding that my attending it should not imply any obligation to the occult brotherhood. He granted permission, adding that for the first time in the history of the temple I would be allowed to attend a service without putting on a black silk robe. Footnote. Furthermore, as a special favor, one was also authorized to visit the library room in the residential buildings where guests who have not yet become members of the Brotherhood are practically never admitted. I thanked him and withdrew, respectfully greeted. Footnote. A major black silk robe is worn at special festivals, and at the audiences of the prince. A minor black silk robe is worn at ordinary divine services. Only the ruler can grant exceptions. by all the court officials and masters of ceremony when I passed outside the many persons whose receptions I had delayed by the excessively long audience. I left the palace and walked back to the guest house. I sent a servant to Naabu, informing him that I had had a long and interesting audience with the ruler, that I should not come to dinner but would attend divine service the same evening, since I had obtained permission to do so from the exalted jewel.